Welcome to Encounter. I'm Margaret Coffey. Today we hear about events on the intersection between religion and politics, this time in Britain, in the wake of the British general election.
These are idealistic, immature politics which stem from psychological needs of people who are turning, in my view, to a surging aspect of Christian doctrine and seeking to inject it into British politics in a way which is inimical, both to the wider population and in particular to the older population, but is inimical because it essentially is disregarding reality.
Former British Labour MP Leo Absey stating forcefully his view about the rhetoric and religious imagery used by New Labour under the leadership of Prime Minister Tony Blair. When Britain's New Labour so unequivocally ousted the Conservatives under John Major, it brought to government many members of Parliament who are affiliated with the Christian Socialist movement within the Labour Party. The new Prime Minister is himself a long-time member of CSM.
I was brought up a Christian, but actually it was really only at university that I became interested in it, as opposed to something that was just part of my heritage, if you like. And I began to think about the ideas, and it was very much part, I think, of political awakening too. The two things went together in a way.
So you don't think religion, like one of the theoretical fathers of the Labour Party once said, is the opium of the masses?
No, I don't think that, actually. Like so much else, I think it was Karl Marx that said that? Yes. I think it is a distortion, actually. I don't think it's that at all. I think that provided Christianity doesn't become an escape from the real world, but becomes an ideal that you aspire to within the real world, I think it's very positive, politically and individually for people.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The phenomenon of Christian socialism in the Labour Party has provoked mixed reactions, echoing on the Labour side of politics some of the views expressed by Margaret Thatcher about the proper relationship between politics and religion. In December 1996, some months before the general election, the BBC's Radio 4 Sunday programme broadcast this.
Since the late leader of the Labour Party, John Smith, made his appeal to reclaim the ground, the Christian Socialist movement has seen a steady increase in membership to 40 MPs, eight of whom currently serve in the Shadow Cabinet. But this isn't to everyone's liking, even within the party itself. And there's a fear being voiced that a bandwagon's been set in motion, which the Labour Party as a whole might be best advised to let by unboarded.
The Sunday programme substantiated concerns about Christian socialism with a comment from Glasgow Govan MP Ian Davidson.
I'm cynical about some of those who seem to be attracted towards this Christian socialist movement, because they just see that, as far as I can perceive, as being where the action is. And I think there is an element of jumping on the bandwagon from some. That's not to say that there are not a large number who are genuine and absolutely sincere in their beliefs, but it's undoubtedly become somewhat fashionable to be involved with Christian socialism in the way that it used to be fashionable, for example, to be involved with, say, anti-apartheid or CND.
And parliamentary sketchwriter Matthew Paris, who's in the Commons every day it sits, has also noticed concern amongst Labour MPs.
You won't find many, if any, Labour MPs prepared to say on record that they are either chilled or unsettled by Christian socialism within the Labour Party. They don't dare to say it. It's quite clearly the coming thing, so far as the leadership and those around the leadership is concerned, that if you want to get on in New Labour, then Christian socialism is a help. So no one's going to criticise it in public. Privately, I could name you 20 or 30 Labour MPs who are deeply disturbed about the whole thing, who don't see the Labour Party as the extension of Christianity by other means, and indeed don't see Christianity as the extension of socialism by other means, who think the two should be kept separate and who are afraid that those waters are being muddied.
British parliamentary sketchwriter Matthew Paris. Well, are his fears justified? David Cairns is director of the Christian Socialist Movement in London.
Yeah, well, that is just a silly criticism that has been made by one or two journalists who quite simply never bothered to pick up the phone to ask. The facts speak for themselves. There are 419 Labour members of Parliament, of whom 50 are Christian socialists. There are 22 members of the British Cabinet, of whom 5 are Christian socialists. You know, these figures do not represent a great groundswell of or a majority or anything like a majority. Our members of Parliament are Labour members of Parliament, first, second and third. They are committed to the Labour manifesto and making it happen.
There's an urgency to making it happen. 5 million Britons live in homes where nobody works. 1 million people have never worked since leaving school. There's a higher proportion of single-parent families than anywhere else in Europe. But when the new government quotes these figures, critics of Christian socialist influence detect a tone of moral authoritarianism.
I don't detect a sense of unease in the country at large. I don't think that what New Labour stands for is moral authoritarianism, although there are some very liberal journalists who do kind of bleat about this. What we've seen yesterday was in this country, in Great Britain, we saw that we are actually the most crime-ridden country in the world. It did even shock us, who knew that the Conservative government has been fiddling the figures on crime for many years, that people are more likely to be the victims of contact crime in Britain than they are in America and anywhere else throughout Europe. We do have a problem with crime in this country, and we have a massive problem with juvenile crime. We are locking up more people than any other country in Europe, with the exception of Turkey. We're actually bringing in prison ships from America, great hulking prison ships, where we can put our extra prisoners into. We've had a policy of putting lots of money into prison building and locking up lots of people, which manifestly hasn't been working. And what the Labour Party has said is, we've got to tackle this problem at source. And Tony Blair coined a phrase which has become very famous in this country, where he said that he wants to be tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime. Part of being tough on the causes of crime is about tackling unemployment, is about tackling social exclusion, is about getting young people and long-term unemployed off of benefit and into work. That's part of the problem. But other part of the problem with causes of crime has been a tolerance of very young people, you know, getting into petty crime, getting into, you know, acts of vandalism at the age of 10, 11 and 12, leading their way into a kind of endless system where we have in the youth justice system in this country of endless warnings but no action taken. People can have 40, 50, 60 warnings before they graduate, before they get to an age where they can actually be punished. So what the Labour Party said is, tough on the causes of crime means being, you know, not tolerant of young people at 10 and 11 wandering the streets at midnight, not being tolerant of kids not turning up to school, not being tolerant where parents are slacking in those areas. And that's what's led to the cries of moral authoritarianism. I think if those cries were getting any head of steam up, they will have been brought juddering to a halt by the crime statistics which have been released in Britain in the last few days, which shows very much that something needs to be done.
David Cairns, who was appointed to direct the CSM's office 3 years ago, when it professionalised itself by acquiring Westminster premises and full-time staff.
My own background was in Christian ministry. I worked in a church in South London, but during that time I became more politically active, and following the general election defeat of the Labour Party in 1992, which was our fourth consecutive defeat, I realised that it was time for people to really commit themselves if they wanted to see a change of government in this country and a change of heart for the nation, that we really couldn't stay on the sidelines any longer. So I began to become more actively involved in the politics of the Labour Party, which inevitably led to my becoming more involved with the Christian Socialist Movement. And when the Christian Socialist Movement was appointing its first ever full-time staff and our first ever Westminster office, I applied for the job and got it 3 years ago.
When you say you were working in a church, were you working as an ordained person?
I was, yes. I was a minister in a church in South London. I mean, it wasn't practical or possible to continue in both areas at the same time. Obviously, politics is a very time-consuming business. It requires a great deal of commitment, as does the ministry, which requires a fairly constant, if not total commitment. So it was a bit of a difficulty trying to, as I did for a while, try to juggle both at the same time. I couldn't manage that, so I moved into full-time work in the political arena.
The vice-chair of the CSM is Stephen Timms, Member of Parliament for East Ham in East London.
I wouldn't say there are two or three people who are the current prophets of Christian socialism. I think the growth of the influence of Christian socialism in the last 5 years or so has really come from people in churches who've joined the Labour Party, and the number of people in the CSM has multiplied by about five, I think, in the last 5 years. It seems to have come from the grassroots and from the bottom, rather than from any particular charismatic leadership figures who've emerged.
Stephen Timms represents the multicultural heart of London. He gets Labour Party pre-selection with the support of Muslims, Sikhs and Buddhists, who find themselves united, David Cairn says, in a sense of a moral code. Stephen Timms joined the CSM in the early 1980s.
I went along to a Bible class that was operating near my home. My family wasn't a church-going family. I didn't have any connections with the churches prior to that. I went along to this class, a thing called Crusaders, and decided in the course of that that I wanted to make a commitment to the Christian faith and build my life on that basis. I have always supported the Labour Party, although I didn't actually join the Labour Party until I left college and got a job. I joined the CSM at that time because it seemed to be an organisation that represented the two things that were, for me, the most important commitments that I wanted to make.
Christian socialists in Britain, like Stephen Timms, look back a century to find their antecedents. But today's formal and organised Christian socialist movement goes back no further than 1960, when a number of smaller organisations amalgamated. Since some of them were apologists for Stalinist Russia, the CSM is obliged to maintain a critical pride in its heritage.
So was Jesus a socialist or merely a radical progressive?
I don't know. Well, I think there was a strong element of socialism in him. But,
do you think so?
I think the
socialism meant, in the British context, very much the radical and cooperative, pretty masculine, looking back on it, sense of human solidarity. Now, when you get much beyond that, you get differences. The majority of the people who use the word socialism are usually thinking of some kind of, or were, state system that could be captured and used for the benefit of the great majority.
Adrian Cunningham. In the early 1960s, he was one of a group of Catholic radicals responsible for a journal called Slant. With latter-day literary critic Terry Eagleton, he produced the Slant Manifesto.
Their focus was very much related to the Labour Party. The sense of a particular kind of Englishness, Anglicanism, although it incorporates the free churches, and the Labour Party had a very sort of powerful and reputable tradition. Our perspectives were necessarily going to be almost as much on what we thought was going on in Brazil, what they were up to in Rome, as what was going on in the UK.
We look to way back into the middle of the last century, in fact to 1848, as the beginnings of Christian socialism in Britain, when the very first radical Christians came together and produced the first Christian socialist pamphlet. And throughout the Victorian era in this country, there were mostly clergy who were very radical and very committed, and they worked in very poor and very rundown areas, but not just in the traditional way of sort of dispensing charity. They did actually have a radical commitment to making a change in society. That carried on into the formation of the Labour Party in the early part of this century, and many of the early founders of the Labour Party were Christian socialists. Some of your listeners may have heard of Keir Hardie, who was the founder of the modern Labour Party in this country. And what Keir Hardie said was, our task as socialists is to take the Sermon on the Mount, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit and so on, and to legislate for that. And throughout the history of the Labour Party, there have been many Christian socialist figures of very great prominence. It's not a new organisation, but it is an organisation which has, if you like, stepped up a gear in the last few years.
One of the elements in the stepping up a gear was, as the BBC Sunday programme intimated, the leadership given by John Smith, Tony Blair's predecessor at the helm of the Labour Party, and the man, it seemed, who would lead the party back into government, while it still held to the public ownership of the means of production.
Mr. Smith, was any of this commitment to the cause the result of strong religious belief?
Partly, I think. I was brought up in the Highlands. I'm an active and professing member of the Church of Scotland.
Psalm 23, sung in Gaelic by Kenner Campbell. His Scottishness was an essential part of John Smith, a man who never lost the sense of community he gained as a schoolmaster's son in a small fishing port in Argyll, and who had himself...
Well, one of the most attractive features, I think, of the Church of Scotland is that they speak out in politics. Now, I and many others might not agree with what they say, but no one, thank goodness, says the Church has not got a right to speak. It seems to me some other churches in this country are still struggling with the question as to whether they should speak or not, or be permitted to speak or not. The Church of Scotland, thank goodness, says it. Now, if the Church means anything in modern society, it must speak out clearly on political issues in which the moral values of Christianity are involved. Gloria, Gloria, Gloria.
When John Smith died in 1994, his body was taken to Iona for burial. It was a significant gesture. From Iona, there has grown an influential contemporary Christian movement. Ecumenical, but coming out of the Protestant tradition, it combines prayer, meditation, and social action.
He will walk a little in front of us into controversy. He will not be scared, though we are apprehensive. He will argue with the intelligent, contradict the self-assured, embrace the untouchable, upset bank balances by his outlandish behaviour in the sanctuary, and weep in public. Then he will go on again, in faith, towards a garden.
Behold, behold, I make all things new, beginning with you and starting from today. Behold, behold, I make all things new, my promise is true, for I am Christ the way.
Mr. Torcher, you have been speaking about Mr. Smith's Christian values.
Yes, that's what touched me with the man. Yeah, baby, got wonderful Christian principles. I believe that's what we need in this nation. Because myself, I'm a Christian, and I believe in the Word of God when it says it's righteousness that exalt a nation.
Tony Blair is a Christian socialist, has been a member of the Christian socialist movement for some time, and would, I think, draw very strongly from his own sense of a radical gospel, of a kind of Christian understanding of the world, an understanding of the role of the individual in the world. And I think that underpins a large amount of his own personal political creed, which he, without using religious language and without using a kind of theological language, it's a creed which he has managed to communicate very, very successfully. It was about, yes, I am my brother and my sister's keeper. Yes, I do have rights, but I also have responsibilities, that the individual in the community is stronger than the individual in isolation. And I think this is sometimes leads to a problem for people. People say, what is uniquely Christian socialist? And I say, well, there are lots of things which we draw from the scriptures, but they're not unique values, but they're values which we hold dear, but which we actually believe are universal values.
Essentially, the only difference is that a Christian socialist MP is a Christian, someone who's committed to the Christian faith, who regularly goes to church and sees their life and their political work as deeply influenced by their Christian faith. So I see really the Christian influence on the new government as being about the way the government does its work rather than on specific measures that the new government is likely to introduce. I think the other point I'd make is that for the whole of the left now, with the disappearance of the Soviet bloc and so on, there is a question about where the ideology of the left is going to come from. And what I'd like to see, and I think there is an opportunity for Christians in the Labour Party, for the Christian churches, through their Labour Party members, to be the source for a large chunk of Labour's ideology in these years ahead, as, of course, the churches were, that Methodism was right at the beginning and the foundation of the Labour Party 100 years ago, and perhaps much less so in the last 20 or 30 years. I think there is an opportunity now for a much bolder and more vocal Christian input to the ideology of our party.
Member of Parliament, Stephen Timms.
I think what we're talking about is something very loose and vague, and it's probably quite easy to call yourself a Christian socialist because the original Christian socialists had no clear manifesto, no clear program. So what you have to believe in order to call yourself a Christian socialist is not all that clear. But I presume if you combine a strong religious sense with a sense of social responsibility, that's probably enough to call yourself a Christian socialist.
David Phillips. He's an historian with a special interest in 19th century British history, and he's tempering his enthusiasm for Tony Blair's Great Britain Limited, he says, until he sees what comes out of it. It's crucial to understand the origins of the British Christian Socialist movement. They're to be found in the world's first industrial revolution.
By the 1830s, let's say, 1830s and 1840s, the Industrial Revolution was very much underway. It was very clear that something new was happening. And the social effects of this were becoming very visible. Now, some people at the time thought that it was very exciting. Some people thought it was very frightening. Some people thought it was a combination of the two. In fact, there are many good commentators who point out both the dangers and fears that were provoked and also the exciting possibilities. The 1830s is when they take up seriously issues like child labour in factories, also women working in factories and in mines, issues of public health, issues of social welfare. The notorious New Poor Law was passed in 1834, which brought in a very harsh deterrent form of public relief, and so on. Now, along with the Industrial Revolution, you've also got to put the effect of the French Revolution, which had a very considerable effect on British politics and British ideas ever since 1789, or particularly, let's say, the 1790s. And the combination of those two gave rise to a lot of democratic movements, particularly among the nascent working class, who were starting to push for political rights, also economic rights.
You working men of England, one moment now attend, while I unfold the treatment of the poor upon this land. For nowadays the factory lords have brought the labour law, and daily are contriving plans to prove our overthrow. So arouse you.
The major working class movement from the late 1830s is the movement we normally call the Chartist movement, or Chartism, which was a sort of umbrella movement taking in a lot of these grievances and arguing that they could be dealt with by means of effectively political reform. The 6 points of the Charter were a call for democratic reform as we'd understand it nowadays, and all but one of those points have long become part of a normal democratic system. The one that hasn't is annual elections. The others, that is universal suffrage, vote by secret ballot, equal constituencies, payment of members and so on, have become normal features of democratic movements. But at the time, it was seen as a very dangerous and radical movement.
So arouse you, sons of freedom, the world seems upside down. They scorn the poor man as a thief in country and in town.
Now, socialism itself had appeared, socialism, socialist had appeared as words in the 1820s, more or less simultaneously in Britain and France. In Britain, the socialist movement was associated with Robert Owen, the Owenite socialist movement, in France with Fourier and Saint-Simon. And although they were not connected, they were actually pushing for very similar things. The Owenites tended to emphasise cooperation as opposed to competition. This is also, incidentally, the period when classical political economy, or as we now call it, economic rationalism, begins. Adam Smith, Malthus, Ricardo, their works were published in this period and were enormously influential, pushing an idea of laissez-faire economics, supply and demand, free market, free trade.
When I survey the world,
So there's this clash of ideas, clash of activities. Into this situation comes a group of upper or middle class propertied people who are disturbed by what they saw happening. That is, they were aware that there were things wrong with the society. They were aware that the working class had legitimate grievances, but they were frightened by what they saw of Chartist and socialist activity. And there are a variety of reactions, but one of the reactions is produced by the group that we normally call the Christian Socialists. They are people with a social conscience, but they don't want too violent, too radical change. We're talking about a rather small movement, and indeed maybe we're talking more about a few influential individuals more than anything else.
Who were they?
Well, the sort of people you would think of with the emergence of Christian Socialism would be the Reverend F.D. Morris, who was a very socially minded clergyman who founded the Working Man's College, for instance, very much concerned with working class education. The novelist Charles Kingsley.
Who was also a priest.
He was indeed. I suppose he's remembered best nowadays for his children's book, The Water Babies, but at the time he would have been much better known for his adult fiction, of which the two novels that most closely reflect his Christian socialist message would be Alton Locke, which is about a Chartist tailor who is concerned to try and find justice and ultimately gets the Christian socialist message, and Yeast, which is more about a socially minded young aristocrat who sort of finds the way, I suppose, to help the people.
Then would you too say that God punishes one class for the sins of another? Some would say, answered Lancelot, half aside, that he may be punishing them for not demanding their right to live like human beings, to all those social circumstances which shall not make their children's life one long disease. But are not these pestilences a judgment on the rich, too, in the truest sense of the word? Are they not the broad, unmistakable seal to God's opinion of a state of society which confesses its economic relations to be so utterly rotten and confused that it actually cannot afford to save yearly millions of pounds worth of the materials of food, not to mention thousands of human lives? Is not every man who allows such things hastening the ruin of the society in which he lives by helping to foster the indignation and fury of its victims? Look at that group of stunted, haggard artisans who are passing us. What if one day they should call to account the landlords whose covetousness and ignorance make their dwellings hells on earth?
It's interesting you mention The Water Babies, which is a very moral tale. Reading Charles Kingsley, one has a sense that his Christian socialism has a lot to do with the morality of personal relationships and how that will infect social relationships, rather than with an idea of socialism that we might have in our minds now.
I think that's a very good point, Margaret. In fact, I would see that as a key way of understanding much of this. They used the term socialism, but they clearly don't mean state socialism as we would think of it nowadays. They don't really see the state as playing much of a role, although they do feel there's some role for the state in terms of social welfare and so on. But their emphasis is on personal conversion, that in fact the change must come within your heart. And that tends to be the message that comes out of Kingsley's novels. And in that way, it's a slightly stronger version of what was already there in the British upper class, which is a sort of paternalism. And that enjoyed a great revival in the 1830s and 40s as well. The paternalist idea is that the upper class are entitled to have their privileges and their comforts in return for doing their duty towards the lower orders. The best-known example, I suppose, of that in the 30s and 40s would be Lord Shaftesbury. Very conservative politically, but believing that, in fact, the upper class must do things for the working class. So he pushes things like factory legislation, mining legislation and so on, protection of children, protection of women, from a conservative background, but with the argument that they have interests to be looked after. The Christian socialists go a little bit further, and I suppose they see themselves as being fairly daring in calling themselves socialists. Charles Kingsley, in many ways, is a rather conservative figure. I mean, he believes in what comes to be called muscular Christianity, the idea that physical activity, cold showers and so on are good for you. And a little later on, he clearly takes some rather right-wing views on some major political issues, let's say by the 1860s. Another one who would seem to fit into that category, who called himself a Christian socialist, also in some ways a well-known novelist, is Thomas Hughes, the author of Tom Brown's School Days, which was the founding public school novel, the one that in a sense created that genre. And yet Hughes, who became an MP, was very dedicated to the Christian socialist idea, saw himself as having an obligation to his working class. Well, they weren't constituents because most of them didn't have the vote yet, concerned with furthering the interests of trade unions, changing the legislation relating to trade unions and so on. And yet this comes from a background educated at Rugby School. In fact, Hughes had picked up his ideas from Dr. Arnold, the headmaster of Rugby, who preached this doctrine of Christian responsibility. And he translated that into a form of Christian socialism.
This I know, that if my heroes go on as they have set forth, looking with single mind for some one ground of human light and love, some everlasting rock whereon to build, then they will find in time the thing they seek. But alas, between them and it are waste raging waters, foul mud banks, thick with dragons and sirens. For it was a true vision which John Bunyan saw, when he beheld in his dream that there was indeed a land of Beulah, and Arcadian shepherd paradise, on whose mountain tops the everlasting sunshine lay, but that the way to it went past the mouth of hell, and through the valley of the shadow of death.
Part of Charles Kingsley's epilogue to his novel, Yeast, published in 1848, the year of the Chartist demonstration in London and revolution in Europe.
These are idealistic, immature politics which stem from psychological needs of people.
Well, Christian socialists stand in a tradition, and as David Phillips points out, so do their critics.
Well, now that's another interesting story. When Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto in 1848, at which stage, of course, there wasn't really much of a communist movement. They try and make it sound more than it is. One of the things they're concerned to do is to distinguish what they call their German or scientific socialism from the other forms of socialism that were around at the time. So they stigmatise the Owenite and Fourierist socialism as utopian socialism. And they do have a little sharp passage about Christian socialism. They say, this is from the Communist Manifesto, "Nothing is easier than to give Christian asceticism a socialist tinge. Has not Christianity declaimed against private property, against marriage, against the state? Has it not preached in the place of these charity and poverty, celibacy and mortification of the flesh, monastic life and mother church? Christian socialism is but the holy water with which the priest consecrates the heart burnings of the aristocrat." A dismissive sentence, that last one, but not entirely unfair, perhaps.
One of the things that Christian socialism has often held to is that we don't subscribe to a particular set of means towards the end. We've been looking at the kind of society that we want to see. We've been looking at the sort of values and principles which should underpin and undermine that society. The particular set of kind of economic strictures or current economic trends or theories, which sometimes socialism has latched onto and said, this is the way to achieve the ends. Christian socialism has never been particularly caught up with that. And I think that's partly why there's been a revival of interest in Christian socialism in this country, because part of the sort of economic strictures that socialism got tied into, which have been discredited, have been seen to be not the be-all and end-all of a sort of centre-left political perspective. You don't have to believe in nationalisation in order to believe in a good and decent and fair and just society. You don't have to believe in state control of all industry and all services in order to believe in greater equity and equality of opportunity and so on. And I think Christian socialism has always belonged to that strand of what we would call ethical socialism, as opposed to what some people might call scientific or deterministic socialism.
David Cairns. Christian socialism, he says, is not wishy-washy. And the fact that New Labour lacks a hard edge of theory doesn't stand up as criticism.
Well, I mean, you can have a hard edge in ideological approach to the cows come home if it doesn't actually create one single solitary job. It doesn't actually create, a better society. What our society has lacked for too long is a clear vision of a just society, a clear vision where there is genuine equality of opportunity. We had endless doctrinal and ideological commitments. We had endless economic theories. We had endless nuances on how we were going to do this and that and the next thing, but we had no vision which could capture people's imagination and could bring people into sharing our vision and moving forward with us. You know, and as the scripture says, without vision, the people perish. What the left had to do in Britain was to lift its game out of out of its own internal discussion with itself and constantly refining and polishing up our own ideology and actually start talking to the people and what the people wanted and what the people aspired to.
A community is a unity of persons as persons. Equality and freedom are constitutive of community, and the democratic slogan, liberty, equality, fraternity, is an adequate definition of community, of the self-realisation of persons in relation.
Words from the philosopher John McMurray, whose career spanned the 20s through to the 50s. John McMurray's reputation is reviving in Britain, along with the interest in Christian socialism. And that's despite the best efforts of Leo Apsey, who in a recent book spent several pages arguing in favour of McMurray's decline into obscurity. McMurray was a philosopher out of step with the dominant analytical mode of British philosophy, more in tune with personalist philosophers on the continent. You'd go looking for like voices, says theologian Graham Cole.
Places like France and Emmanuel Mounier, someone who's inherited something of that legacy, Paul Ricoeur. You could look to the United States and to someone like Borden Parker Bone, University of Boston, and his successor, Edgar Sheffield Brightman, and probably the most famous graduate of that school of thought, Martin Luther King. And if you look to Jewish philosophy, you could look no further than Martin Buber.
McMurray seems to have been much more open to continental developments. I know, for instance, that he was a kind of mentor to the philosopher Theodor Adorno when Adorno spent time in England between the wars.
Philip Conford. He has edited a collection of extracts from McMurray's works, published last year and graced with a foreword by Tony Blair. The Personal World, it's called, John McMurray on Self and Society. McMurray's philosophy, says Blair, offers insights which will assist in a new settlement for individual and society.
What he wants to do is to try to explain human life in terms of the personal. He says that philosophers, under the influence of science, have tried to interpret human life mechanistically. Then, as the biological sciences developed, they tried to interpret human life in terms of an organism. He felt that since psychology began to develop at the beginning of this century, that there ought to be an interpretation of human life based on the idea of human personality. So he wanted to try to develop a philosophy which would bring together all aspects of human life, to look at a human being as somebody who wasn't isolated, somebody who wasn't purely mental, as you have the starting point of modern philosophy with Descartes, the isolated thinking self. He wanted to analyse human life in terms of an embodied person who was related to other people.
This relationship occurs within community, something distinct from communitarianism on the one hand and collectivism on the other.
I think here is where you can see the influence on Tony Blair, who seems to be trying to steer between socialist collectivism on one hand and Thatcherite individualism on the other. I think that McMurray's view of community is probably more far-reaching than communitarianism. You see, I could see in communitarianism the danger of something which is actually rather inward-looking. For McMurray, the whole logic of community is that it should spread outwards until it becomes universal, the idea of the brotherhood of man. If that community becomes something which is in some way defensive, which defines itself against the rest of the world, against the surrounding society,
I think that would actually be incompatible with McMurray's thought.
One of the problems with McMurray's argument is that it was made within the context of enormous hope for Christianity. A multicultural, multi-religious society was not within McMurray's sights.
I think you've put your finger on something very important there, actually. This occurred to me when I was rereading him in order to prepare the anthology. He is really quite cavalier in his treatment of other religions, I think it has to be said. I mean, that they are summed up as part of his plan. He only really deals with Buddhism, which he sees as a contemplative religion, and with Islam, which he sees as an aggressive, extroverted religion. It's all very oversimplified in order to fit into his scheme. I think that maybe, and this is only a tentative suggestion, maybe that what McMurray would have said, and I'm basing this on some of the ideas he puts forward in a book, The Clue to History, is that what matters is the intention towards community. I sometimes feel that McMurray would say that if you achieved a universal community, then that would be a full development of Christianity, even though that community wasn't nominally Christian. And that's the only real response which I can think of to this problem.
I refer to McMurray as an example of a personalist philosopher. I like the way he summed up his philosophy, that knowledge is for the sake of action and action is for the sake of friendship. That's quite an illuminating remark. But in a whole range of areas, he's dated. You'd have to do a lot of extra work to see how McMurray applies to a pluralist society. Also, his understanding of the Jesus story and what the kingdom of God is about seems very old-fashioned liberal theology, you know, the brotherhood of man sort of stuff. He doesn't seem to have really interacted with those understandings of Jesus that underscore his Jewishness and the apocalyptic nature of the kingdom of God.
There's a palpable excitement in the tone of the British religious press at the advent of so many acknowledged Christian MPs. Immediately after the election, the Church of England Church Times headlined its front page with "Christians take top jobs." The Christian nature of the new government was becoming clear, it said, as the Prime Minister finished assembling his senior team. There were Christian socialists in almost every government department and swathes more on the back bench. Other journals point to hopes of ethical government, a new moral consensus. But it's not only some non-Christians who have reservations about Christian socialism. The fact is, not all Christians welcome it, or indeed any kind of formal association between Christianity and party politics.
We are seeing, as individuals, our reading of the scriptures has led us to a left of centre political position. End of story. We are not saying you have to follow us. What we do not believe is that there should be such a thing as a Christian political party, which would be prescriptive, which would say you can only, if you're a Christian, you must support this because we are the party with the word Christian in our name, that only Christians can join, that we have the sum total of Christian understanding and Christian wisdom. There have been moves in this country to found a Christian Democrat party. I do oppose that.
Or presumably you have a problem with Christians who say that politics is not for them, it's not for Christians.
Yes, they're reading the wrong Bible, as Desmond Tutu said, who, you know, whoever says Christianity and politics don't mix isn't reading the same Bible as he is. I can understand people's reticence to get too involved in party politics. I don't agree with it, but I can understand it. But, you know, we live in the midst of our society and we do have obligations to the society in which we live. And it is right and fitting that Christian men and women who do have principles and values should seek to implement those in the kind of modern democratic, liberal democratic society in which we live. The best way of doing so, the most effective way of doing so, is through the means of the existing political parties, through the existing political structures, and that's the way I would commend people to journey. What is not an option, I don't think, for those Christians who say, Christianity floats above the world and floats above politics, and people shouldn't get involved, and that politics is all very grubby, and it's, you know, it's all very secular, whereas Christianity is involved in higher things. I think the reality of the incarnation blows that argument out of the water. Christianity is a religion predicated upon the fact that God so loved the world that he gave his only son to come into the world and walk among us. Once you accept that profound reality, the option for the Christian of withdrawing from the world is simply not viable.
Adrian Cunningham is a Christian who's not entirely pessimistic about the prospects for New Labour. He points to the new government's adoption of the campaign to end the manufacture and distribution of landmines.
It seems to me inconceivable that the previous regime or regimes would have contemplated that, given the amount of UK investment and personnel involved in the arms trade. So I think that that's a specific example of a sort of mixture of left and Christian-influenced factors that would make the Blair government put that very high on its agenda. Yes, the sense of general vagueness, that's because the chap wanted to get elected. Yes, a lot of that is rhetoric. And the room for manoeuvre in a world of global corporations, you just open up in one country and then shut down again 5 years later because the tax benefit's better somewhere else. There is very little room for manoeuvre for political parties. But I think because there are no pure Christian positions, they're always in a certain context and they're always drawing strands out of the background. The Christian thing, if it's hijacking socialism, well, it'll fail. What I think the Christian elements that might be there that are, to me, important are partly it comes out of scripture and theology. It also comes out of 2,000 years of tradition. Would be that a word like community can have more focus. It starts with an assumption that we are who we are because we are always in relation to other people. That the basic element without which there is nothing else has to be community. And politics can't produce it. It can assist it or it can destroy it.
The Christian Socialist Movement in Britain has published a number of books. If you'd like their details and the details of Philip Conford's edition of John McMurray's writings, please contact Encounter at the ABC in your area. Thanks to Martin Lawrence for production. I'm Margaret Coffey.
One change that I found important is still got some way to go, is that there used to be a tendency to think that Christianity would somehow turn the world into itself. I always keep coming back to scriptural bits that always describe the Christians as things like salt and yeast. Absolutely vital, but you can't live on them. If there is a difference, I would hope it would be that against all the odds, everything in the end can be and will be redeemed.
Oh.